Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roering, Samantha Schreiber, and our special guest in studio right now is Dennis Denno with Denno Research. He is also a candidate for the Michigan State University Board of Trustees. Dennis, good to see you again.
Oh, thanks. Thanks. Great to be back.
You going to sing the fight song for us?
I don't think anybody wants to hear me sing any song.
But he does have his Dennis Denno for Michigan State University Trustee hat.
You should auction those off.
Oh, and someone, you're the second person who said that. Yeah, they're actually, not to brag, I really like them.
That's cool.
Yeah. You didn't bring any for us that we could put downstairs? Yeah. We've got a MAGA hat. We've got
Kid Rock for U.S. Senate. We've got a Rick Snyder.
Well, I can definitely improve your hat collection then.
Yeah, you could improve it.
It's certainly
green and white. I might have to borrow and wear it. I left them.
There you go.
Let's start talking about the Democratic Convention first. And Samantha, you were covering that for us. Give us a little bit of your perceptions on what you saw. This was a kind of a hybrid convention where some people were online and some people were in person. So what did you see?
Yes, and I do have a question for Dennis about that, but we did have more than 50% of the precinct delegates attending virtually that were Zoomed in. I mean, it was a very high energy, very positive environment. I've had multiple people describe it as a family reunion for the Michigan Democratic Party. And when I was talking to different delegates, one of my favorite questions, my go-to question was, what are your top three issues right now? And nearly everyone said on the top of their list was voter rights. So kind of talking about some of the different efforts that are kind of like strengthen the ID to vote protocols, things that would make it more confusing to enter and to understand your ballot, to cast a ballot, et cetera. Those are things that it seemed that a lot of delegates are very worried about and how this could limit access to voters in low-income minority communities. And then another concern of theirs was also all of these ballot proposals. They're afraid that voters are going to get confused when they go in to vote.
And so that means that they all go down and maybe one of the ballot proposals that they want then gets swept up into that whole vote no kind of mentality?
When I was having my conversations, there's a concern that some voters are going to get all these different ballot proposals confused, not quite sure which one's which. They're going to go into a polling booth in November, and when they get to the bottom, let's say in a perfect world, these 10 plus ballot proposals end up on the ballot. They're going to look at them and they're either going to be so exhausted, have no idea or even want to read these ballot proposals. Or they're just going to really not sure what they all entail and not feel prepared to cast a vote on them. So there's a real concern of making sure that voters are educated going into November.
We do have some experience with that when we had 6 ballot proposals back when Snyder was in office, and there was a coordinated campaign, just vote no on them all, and that ended up happening. That actually did happen. Dennis, this has been one of you. How many conventions have you been to? Democratic conventions. Can you even count?
I mean, probably the first one I went to would have been 92 or 94. Definitely 94.
Yeah, okay. So you've been to a few. Tell our listeners how this one was different.
Well, as you said, I mean, it was in person. That was awesome. It was great to see people. I thought there was a lot more energy than I expected. There was a lot more people there than I thought. I think the interesting thing is there was no fights. Democrats are united. There was not one floor fight. There is not one contentious fight for any of these education positions. It's the complete opposite of what's happening in the Republican Party.
Yeah. Now, where was the big convention at where the folks were officially endorsed? We saw the pictures of Whitmer and Nessa. What room was that in, Dennis?
That was in the ballroom of what's now called TCF Center.
Or Huntington.
It's TCF. Isn't it TCF Place?
Well, it was. Now it's Huntington Place now.
Okay.
But you made
Huntington
it there.
Place. Yeah, I made it there. I found it.
You found it.
Yeah. So I think most of us still call it the COBOL, which we're not supposed to do anymore.
But as far as the room itself, how full was that room then, that ballroom? Because I've been there the last one 4 years ago. That place was packed.
Yeah, no, I mean, it was not packed, and they had too many chairs. But, I mean, there's probably 500 to 750 people there. So it was a lot more than I thought would be there.
So that was my question, too, was did the virtual component of it lessen or dampen?
Oh, no question about it. I mean, if you can do this virtually... but there's people who wanted to be out and see their friends, right. and see, right. you know?
Well, I mean, that was going to be my question, is like the power of an image, you know? So the exactly 1 week before, we had Trump's visit to Washington Township, where it seemed that people not only from Michigan, but all over the Midwest were traveling hours to go see him. There was a ton of precinct delegates in the audience. And then with this event, you know, a lot of delegates chose to attend virtually. And then it seemed kind of once we got into the university board speeches, a lot of those delegates started to leave. Do you think that that shows a conflicting image at all when we talk about the enthusiasm between the two different parties?
Well, I mean, like you said, there was what, something like 50% of the delegates were online. So they made an effort to be there to see what was going on. I mean, it's a lot easier to do something online, especially if you don't have to be there. I mean, there's no, let's face it, there was no real reason to be there unless you wanted to meet the candidates and see your friends. So that I'm not concerned about. It's a great question, but that's not something I would be concerned about.
Now, we were talking with Richard Zuba from the Glenn Gareth Group on Off the Record this past weekend. And he does, as part of his regular polling, something to do with how motivated are certain voters. And that is very helpful in polling because then you know kind of your mix of who you're actually polling. And he said that there is high motivation among both strong Republicans and Democrats, which I found surprising. But he did say there is some softening with leaning Democrats. And I wanted to get your reaction to that idea, Dennis. And how do you get those soft Democrats excited?
Yeah, I mean, it shouldn't be a surprise that strong Republicans, strong Democrats are motivated. I mean, if they're not motivated, then there's big problems, right? No question. I mean, this is going to be a turnout game. And where do those independents, where do those soft Democrats go? And where, you know, do they vote? There's no question that Governor Whitmer and the Democrats in Michigan are going to have a ton of resources. The goal is to get voter turnout out. And as we get closer to the election, and that's what people are going to be talking about. I mean, let's face it. The average person isn't thinking about the November elections right now. Yeah. The average person, I didn't have one person before the convention Saturday ask me or talk to me about MSU trustee.
Really?
Really. No one even knew what was going on.
They wanted to talk sports or something like that, right?
Sure. Yeah. or the weather. But I mean, people aren't paying attention right now.
You mean people didn't start thinking about this election last year like we did?
It's hard to believe that the average person isn't thinking about governor or attorney general or secretary of state. I know, it's crazy.
What else they got to do?
You know, John, something that while Dennis and Samantha were in the convention, one of the things that we did last Friday was we had a webinar in which we brought in Ed Zarpolis, and we had done a statewide survey, and we're talking over some of the results, and a lot of results, and a very good conversation. But something I wanted to bring up for this podcast has to do with Governor Whitmer's popularity among women voters. And this was something that Ed Zarpolis highlighted, and I wanted to talk to you about. But Governor Whitmer and James Craig in a hypothetical matchup were tied 46 apiece among women, even though Whitmer led Craig by a pretty substantial margin. What did you make of that?
You know, I started thinking about that over the weekend some more. And if you think about what happened with COVID, she instituted these restrictions, and whether she was responsible for individual school closings or not, think about all the women who were stuck in their homes with, students, their children, having to learn online. You suddenly drastically changed their lifestyle. I mean, and I gotta believe some of that rubbed off on Governor Whitmer, because she, in a way, was the face of COVID restrictions in the state of Michigan, even though you certainly can't blame her for the fact that we had a pandemic. But I think there's a lot of frustration out there still over COVID that she's going to have to figure out how to message her way out of, because, like I said, she is the face of COVID restrictions in the state of Michigan.
And then I was taking a look at how did Dana Nessel and Joslyn Benson do in head-to-head with women, and Nessel's up by a few points over, hypothetically, over Leonard and Berman, but it's a 10-point gap when it's Dana Nessel versus Matt DiPerno. That's something we can talk about a little later if you want. But and then when it came to Joslyn Benson and her opponents among women, she's also doing a little bit better, 6 points better against Bo LaFave. And then Christina Caramo, She's 18 points better than Christina Caramo, Jocelyn Benson is among women. So it seems like the women are just fine with Dana Nessel and Jocelyn Benson, but when it comes to Gretchen Whitmer, it's there's still a little rub there. What did you think of that, Samantha?
Well, I mean, I just kind of want to echo off of what John just said with, you know, there's a lot of grievances still being aired about the pandemic, and those grievances aren't going to go away anytime soon, especially when we're talking about children. I mean, children are still experiencing very hard-hitting mental health issues and fallbacks because of the pandemic. And, you know, it's the parents that are going to try to do the best to give their kids the help that they need. And of course, you know, that's one thing that the Democratic Party does have going, and something that has been able to get a lot of bipartisan support is more mental health services inside schools for young people. So, I mean, that is something where there could be a lot of improvement on the numbers. And when we talk about the other candidates and their relationships and interactions with women voters, I think with Dana Nessel, I really like how open her rhetoric is. That's how I would feel as a female voter, that she's the type of candidate that can ask if someone has a tampon on the campaign trail. And I think for young women especially, I think it gives them that power that, oh my gosh, like, it's time to start talking openly about what it is to be a woman in the professional world, you know, to be not as filtered as they once were.
And, you know, Dennis, it was not only just the kids at home, it's also being able to see your loved one in nursing homes, let's say. And could we visit mom in the nursing home? The answer is no. And we had, you know, and you had to say hi through the glass window. And rightfully or wrongly, she gets the Governor Whitmer gets the blame for that.
Yeah, I mean, first, let's just, I mean, talking about this poll, where a lot of them were done, you know, as a robo-survey, so I think we need to be careful with those results, because a lot of those have been proven wrong in the past. But let's remember, 4 years ago, polling showed Sri Tanadar winning the Democratic nomination, right? And then once Gretchen Whitmer, who's now Governor Gretchen Whitmer, started doing her TV ads, which were really, really good, she ran away with it, right? So no question that what people are hearing about the governor is not very positive, but I think once she gets her positive message out there, this is going to turn around.
Yeah, and there hasn't been any ads or anything, because I don't think she wants to get into a spending war yet with a billionaire. I mean, as long as she's up in the polls, I think you remember this, John. Remember, we were asking, God, when is Jennifer Granholm going to start engaging with Dick DeVos in 2006? Right. And there was a lot of hand-wringing. We were getting into May. Oh, my God, what's going on? And then when she finally decided, okay, we can get into an air war now, we've got the funding for it, she blew DeVos out of the water.
We talked about that a little bit during the webinar on Friday. And I do think she could probably stand to use a little bit of image building advertising come May, before the dead period of summer. What do you think, Dennis? How long should she wait?
You know, I mean, I guess it depends on her budget, right? And don't forget, not to sound like the old man in the room, and what was it, 2000, when Debbie Stabenow was running against incumbent Spence Abraham? I mean, every single survey showed Spence Abraham beating her. She went on TV, you know, as late as possible, and she won. So, you know, the other thing with Governor Whitmer is I think she's done a much better job in the past, you know, 2-3 months with her messaging, talking more about roads, talking more about healthcare. She's talking about issues that people care about. Perry Johnson is talking about ISO 9000. What is that?
It's quality control, man. I mean, but that is a good point. But if she's talking about the roads, and this was something else that was brought out on the survey, is she's not doing great on the roads. 49% of voters do not see any real change in the road condition.
Yeah, but to be fair, though, there really has not been an earnest, comprehensive messaging campaign about what is happening. All the money that's been generated for the roads, with the infrastructure spending, with her bonding, I think that's part of got to be part of her campaign as far as messaging.
Yeah, and the roads, Michigan roads are terrible in March.
Every March, that's true. And you could improve the quality of roads by 10% across the board, and you'd still get complaints every March.
And, you know, I was at my folks in Metro Detroit, and 696 was under construction. I go to Flint, and Flint roads are under construction. I mean, they're being torn up. Came from East Lansing to MERS World Headquarters. There was construction on the roads.
Yeah, I almost wonder if by fall she's not going to have another problem of orange barrel fatigue because of all the money that's starting to fly.
It's like, what would you prefer, to drive on a road that's doomed with a bunch of potholes or a road that's going to set you back an hour in your commute because of the construction?
Unfortunately, she's a fighter. Neither.
And it's not just state roads. I mean, it's county roads, you know, and it's local roads that are being fixed too.
Well, and I think that's when we look at this bipartisan infrastructure that was passed. You know, there's a lot of people on every side of the aisle that's super excited about it because their counties, their municipalities are finally going to get an infusion.
Right. Last thing I want to talk about here, John, I don't know if this struck you, but the whole point of why we did that statewide survey and then our webinar on Friday was to test Attorney General Dana Nessel and Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson against the different candidates on the Republican side for those two offices. And what we found was that there is a bump that Republicans get if they have Bo LaFave and Tom Leonard as their nominees, as opposed to the Trump-endorsed candidates.
Yep.
For the Secretary of State, it's a pretty good 7% bump. Bo LaFave was at 33% to Benson's 50, and Christina Caramo was at 25% to Benson's 50. And then on the Attorney General, it was 47 to 34 Nessel versus Leonard. And then when you get to DiPerno, it's 49% Nessel, 31% DiPerno.
Yeah. And what's interesting, though, too, is we measured the impact of a Trump endorsement on a general election decision. And while the Republicans are very excited about their Trump-endorsed AG and Secretary of State candidate going into the convention, I'm not sure the general election voter is going to be that much in favor of it by the numbers that we saw. Only 20% found it a positive. I can't remember what you have the numbers there. I think it was 40% would be less likely to vote for a Trump-endorsed candidate.
Yeah, 42% less likely and 20% more likely.
So the Republicans have to be a little weary that they might be excited about their Trump-endorsed candidates, but they could be setting themselves up for more of a challenge in the fall than they need.
Denno, be honest. As a Democrat, you would rather face Matt DiPerno than Tom Leonard.
Oh, yeah, any day of the week, no question about it. And here's the other question is, who's going to fund these Trump-supported Secretary of State and Attorney General candidates? I mean, Donald Trump's not going to give them money. Donald Trump takes money. You know, are the national folks going to come in and fund these Secretary of State and Attorney General candidates? I don't see it.
Yeah, you do got to wonder, does the regular Republican infrastructure that donates these campaigns, when you start talking about the DeVos family, for example, or you know, the folks in Southeast Michigan, I mean, do they open up their wallets? Do they donate to these people? I don't know.
But even the national, like, Republican Attorney General Association, I forget what it's called, and, you know, the national groups that fund Secretary of State races, are they going to invest in these candidates? I don't know.
Well, if you're really a strong pro-Trump Republican and he doesn't open up his purses over some of these endorsements, I think I would be a little frustrated because he's got a huge war chest that's sitting there that he's somewhat limited in what he can spend it on. He could spend it on this.
Trump's a taker. He's not a giver. Trump does not financially help other candidates.
Yeah, and we certainly have seen that so far as what he's been able to give to candidates, and he hasn't given anything. He's given his endorsement. That seems to be enough, though.
Right, and don't forget, if these candidates say one thing or do one thing that Trump doesn't agree with, he has no problem blasting them.
If his endorsed candidates tank, do you think he's at risk of being substantially weaker this time next year?
Oh, yeah, no question. And I think we're seeing his power weakening slowly month by month.
Well, thank you, Dennis, for your commentary and showing up here at MERS World Headquarters. Always good to see you. We're going to shift now to an interview, Samantha, you were able to do with Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson at the convention. We're going to listen to that and then jump into some music and head into the next part of the podcast.
Help me get my feet back on the ground. Won't you please, please help me?
Join us on this segment of the podcast is Heidi Koloff. She is a direct care worker in Midland. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
I wanted to have you on the podcast to kind of explain what you do as a direct care worker. Give us a little bit about your background and what that means to be a direct care worker.
Okay. Well, a direct support professional, they help individuals with mental or developmental disabilities to kind of overcome the things we may take for granted, you know, that prevent them from being self-sufficient, so to speak. So it's a variety of things for each individual.
So give us just a couple examples of some things that you might do for a patient.
Okay. Well, what we do is anywhere from tasks such as helping them prepare their meals. It could be tasks such as teaching. Most of my job is centered around teaching, a lot of teaching, redirecting. So you may help them with their chores. You may teach them various lessons. If it's a little guys, you may teach them how to brush their teeth, proper hygiene, grooming. You may help them get out into the community. So there's a variety of tasks involved, but it goes per individual. So in other words, usually there's some sort of plan of care, because everybody has different goals and different abilities. And so it's really going to depend on each individual that you're working with. But as I've listed some of the things, the daily tasks that maybe you and I take for granted.
Okay. And how long have you been doing this?
Off and on for approximately 10 years.
Yes.
And how did you get into this particular field?
Well, one of my mentors, Miss Lampman, happened to be in this field. She is also my sister. And so I watched her work for many years before me, and I found this to be a great field to go into. Also, I have a grandson who is autistic. So it's just very important to me.
Now, I wanted to have you on the podcast to talk about the rate of pay, because that's an issue here in Lansing about how much direct care workers should be making or can be making. There was a boost that was given to your salaries, I believe, $2 and a quarter. Tell us what kind of impact that had on you.
Oh, that was that is very wonderful. That all of that helps. Direct support care staff usually don't have any kind of health benefits. The wages are usually pretty low. So you need to oftentimes supplement or work long hours. So you either need a second job or you need to work various long hours.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the questions I'm curious about too is the burnout rate, because we had a family member who had a cancer diagnosis. He wound up having in-home care for probably better part of a year. And when I was dealing with him, it's very tiring. I'm just curious, how do you handle the fatigue? How do you handle the stress? Because you could get different patients who are sort of wearing you differently, you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. And I can give you an example with my grandson. He's severely autistic, which means he's nonverbal. And oftentimes, you know, when he's discouraged and he's not able to communicate what his needs are, you may get he may headbutt you, he may slap you, or some kind of behavior like that. And you don't know what's coming sometimes. And so the way I deal with those types of things, or like you said, job burnout, you just have to keep exercising and making sure that you're doing, and I say exercising, it could be reading a book or something like that. You need to make sure that you are taking care of yourself as well as the individuals that you are working with. So it's a lot of, you know, whatever your hobby is, making sure that you're giving your life that balance that everybody needs, really.
To John's point, do you know other people in the profession who have experienced burnout? They've done it for a few months or done it for a couple of years and just said, God, I just can't do this anymore. This is too hard.
Absolutely. And I'm glad that you mentioned that, because there's a gentleman that I work with, and I've watched him go through 17 different people, which is a lot. And especially if you have someone with, say, we'll use my grandson again, autism, they need that same person. Otherwise, you're starting to the learning process all over again with a new person, because he's going to challenge you and he'd take you back from the beginning. So yes, that is a difficulty. I mean, 17 people, that's a lot to go through. That's a lot.
Do you feel that direct care workers are lacking when it comes to having somebody to represent them, to advocate for them in the Capitol, when it comes to sitting at the table with people making decisions?
I do, but you know what? I am seeing something positive. I'm glad you mentioned that. There is a group of people, and us even just discussing this today openly, there's somebody that is starting to see the problems that we're facing. And so it's groups like this, even just that we're able to talk about it, you know? And I am seeing small changes coming, though. There is somebody out there looking and trying to help on our behalf.
Yeah, no. So what is the training like to become a direct care worker? I know that when I was in college, I had a few friends that would go to like the homes of like senior citizens and help mm-hmm. out with some of their medical needs. And mm-hmm. they never really explained to me what type of programs or certificates were required. So I was wondering if you could give me a small rundown of that.
Okay. My situation's a little bit unique. So I have a bachelor's degree, and my training is a lot more intense because I'm also a substitute school teacher. So I have all the HIPAA. I have just a lot more training than a lot of the support staff get. I know that there is, and when I was at the ARC, they did a wonderful job. They were always doing programs to train, but it just depends on the individual. Not everybody's going to need medical. I heard a gentleman say something about their relative had cancer. So not everyone is going to need like the CINA type of training. CINA, and I mean, that's where you're doing full medical care, right? So it just depends, again, on the individual. Did I get the proper training when I went through the ARC? Yes. Do I have more than enough training to work with the two individuals I have right now? Yes. Is that a problem, though? Yes, for other agencies, it sure can be. Yes, absolutely. There's not enough.
How many hours mm-hmm. a week do you work?
I right now, with this, I'm working about, well, with both people, I'm working about 50 hours, and then I do my substitute teaching as well. So I work a lot, a lot of hours. Yes.
And excuse my asking here, but are you up to $15 an hour with the direct care?
I wasn't. I just recently became that because I advocated for myself. Okay. And, you know, I really had to push for that. But, kind of push or fight for that. So there's a lot of people that are not. They're not even close to that, no.
Really?
I know that we talked about rates for a little bit, but what would you describe as like the biggest challenges right now being faced by your industry?
So it could be anything. Does it have to come right down to the bottom dollar? I guess the biggest challenge for me and what I've witnessed is when these agencies, sometimes, like I'm private, but some people hire agencies, when they are so short-handed due to the wages or due to the lack of health insurance or things of that nature, oftentimes they may have to hire maybe subpar people, right? Because they have to fulfill, they need bodies, they need people somewhere. And so oftentimes what I've seen is people that do have a lack of experience in this field, which creates more problems for the people, for not only the agency and the individual that we are assisting, but also it's just a ripple effect. It creates problems for the agency, for the worker themselves, and also for the individual that we are assisting. So that's a pretty serious thing. Yes.
Mm-hmm. As far as the pay, and because I know that this is going to be a conversation that is going to continue here in the legislature, what do you think would be a rate that could get people to stay in the profession and not bail out for other things like working at, I don't know, any other type of profession? There certainly isn't a shortage of jobs right now.
No, there isn't. And that makes it more challenging as well. For me, I'm a little bit older, and so maybe the young people coming in don't care as much, but I don't have benefits, and I don't have in lieu of benefits even. So that kind of makes me sad. And that ties in with wage, okay? Mm-hmm. So there's not a problem with making $15 an hour if you have some sort of health insurance, right? Because that's your money. So I think that, can you ask that question again?
Yeah,
I lost my train of thought.
But then talking about healthcare, do you qualify for Medicaid?
Well, because I work so much, I'm stuck in the middle, sir, because I do the substitute teaching. So they see me as making enough to pay for my own, which then is what, $300 a month? So I don't know. It's just, I think you'd have more qualified people if you offered the same thing you would for any other important career, correct? Mm-hmm. It's no different than maybe a case manager who's just completing paperwork. We're actually doing the difficult, challenging things, correct? Mm-hmm. So why wouldn't you offer the person down in the trenches the same opportunities you do for the folks filling out the papers?
I see what you're saying. And then the other last thing I wanted to ask you about was as far as workload. I'm taking it that you're providing care for two individuals right now. Is that right?
Right now I am. I'm taking care of more than that.
Oh, are you really? Okay.
Oh, yes.
How many people are you providing care for right now?
Right now, I'm taking care of two, but in the past, if you would have asked me this a couple of years ago, it would have been, my number would have been one, maybe five.
Now, if it could, just theoretically, how easy would it be to pick up more people that you could care for? The backlog, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. Is there more need than there are workers to provide the services?
Well, right now, because there are so many shortages with workers, there's an abundance of hours. So absolutely, you could pick up more. They are just overwhelmed. Some of the agencies throughout Midland, I know, they have several thousand hours available for people to pick up along the way to handle that because the shortages right now. Yes.
Heidi Koloff, she is a direct care worker out of Midland. We appreciate you taking some time and talking with us on the MERS Monday podcast.
Thank you.
Inside their clothes with my green gloves, watch their video.
Joining us now on the podcast is Renee Kanaki Jefferson. She is a trustee at Michigan State University, and she also received the endorsement of the Michigan Democratic Party to appear on the 2022 ballot. Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me.
Samantha, go ahead and kick it off.
Yeah, so I was at the convention as well, covering it. I saw you in your awesome pink suit. And I just wanted to ask, you know, what was your favorite memory of Saturday's convention? What was the highlight for you?
I think the highlight for me is just the collective energy, enthusiasm, and strength and intelligence of this slate of Democrats who are going to be alongside me working hard to earn the votes of Michiganders and all cross the line to victory in November. It was really just refreshing and exciting to hear from all of them.
Yeah, I really liked how Kyra Bolden incorporated a pregnancy announcement in her speech for Michigan Supreme Court. I thought that was a really interesting highlight.
Yeah, I agree, to be sure. There were, I think of all of the maybe surprised and more personalized announcements, hers definitely takes the top.
Trustee, I want to turn to a little bit more of a serious subject. You were appointed to the Board of Trustees after a trustee resigned because of the Nassar scandal. And I'm curious, as somebody who teaches legal ethics, what is your view of how the University of Michigan is handling the Anderson case, and how MSU handled the Nassar case, and where we're at with all that?
Well, you're correct. I was appointed after another trustee resigned over disagreement about what to do with the documents related to the Larry Nassar sex abuse scandal. And while I couldn't convince my colleagues on the Board of Trustees to release them, I did sort of my third way. I read them all myself, more than 10,000 pages, to make sure that the information that needed to be publicly available to hold those responsible who needed to be, in fact, had been turned over for accountability. And I think accountability and transparency is paramount in this for any institution that faces it, whether it's one of the institutions you mentioned in our state, the institution that I'm now on the board of, or any of the institutions across the country, because we're not alone. In terms of going forward, I think there have been important steps that have been taken at Michigan State that I can speak to directly. I've really tried to be a champion of change for transparency and accountability in our governance. And that's something that has happened in a number of different ways. Here are some concrete examples. One of the first policies that I demanded we implement when I joined the board was a formal process for reviewing the president's performance every year, a process that is now not only subject to an official policy that we adopted, but it is transparent. We post the results so the public can see it. And it's structures like that that require accountability that will help us prevent the kinds of things like the issues that our institution and others have faced in the past. Another tangible change at Michigan State, together with my colleagues on the Board of Trustees and the president of the university, we worked to replace almost every executive level leadership position from the provost to the chief of police. So there is a whole new group of leaders in Michigan State. And then there's been a real effort to improve a whole range of policies, procedures, and processes, not just in response to what happened with Nassar, but to improve for, hopefully we are improving prevention of sexual assault and sexual harassment on our campus, but we know it's still happening. We know it's still prevalent. One of the more recent surveys in 2019 told us that it is still very prevalent on Michigan State's campus. And so we are doing everything we can to prevent, but also put into place measures that for survivors allow them to get through the process in the best way, the most healing way for them, whether it is improving the timing of the process, or importantly, and this is the last thing I'll say for now, and you can ask me more questions about this if you'd like, but you might know of our new Center for Survivors on Michigan State's campus, which was incredible work done by Professor Rebecca Campbell and others. Dr. Campbell secured a grant that enabled the creation of this extraordinary resource center for anyone in the Michigan State community. So it's not just limited to our students, faculty, and staff. Someone who has survived a sexual assault can come there and receive treatment, and everything from the moment you step into the door, the color of the paint, to the intake process, to the way evidence is collected and stored, to the privacy that is given, the autonomy that is preserved for the survivor. Everything has been carefully thought out to make that the most healing process possible. And so I think, you know, any institution that has grappled with something like Nassar needs to be thinking about all of these things, from how we implement improved processes and structures for accountability to what is the lived experience for anyone who endures something like this.
I also want to ask you a quick question too. You came to the university about the same year as the Dr. Samuel Stanley became the new president. What's your reaction to his tenure?
So I joined the board after he had been hired, but you're right. We are joining relatively at the same time. I think that President Stanley has, well, of course, under his leadership, all of the things that I just described have happened, but he has really been transformative for the campus in many, many ways. I think that he has a bold vision, which is outlined in the strategic plan that he led, but of course, from the sort of ground up with faculty and the Board of Trustees, was heavily involved in adopting and approving, really has an incredible vision for Michigan State's future. And so I've been impressed with his leadership. I think that, of course, there's always work that remains to be done. And sometimes, as you may have noticed, the Board of Trustees, we may disagree about a particular direction. We may not always be in agreement with him, but I have found him to be a good listener. I have found him to be a strong leader. And I think that he is working hard for the future success for Michigan State University.
And I know that there's been reports about a lot of Michigan universities struggling quite heavily with enrollment since 2011. And however, when you look at Michigan State's enrollments numbers, you all have actually gone up by nearly 4%. You know, what would you attribute to that enrollment success when so many universities such as my alma mater, CMU, are, you know, quite struggling very significantly with this?
Well, it's a dynamic that's facing higher education across the country, where some universities are really struggling in the wake of the pandemic. Others, like Michigan State, has seen this uptick in enrollment. And I've wondered the same question. I'm an academic at heart, so I've been looking to see what others researching this attribute it to. And I don't have a empirically sound answer yet as to why this is happening, but I think it has to do with a few things. First, we see this gravitation towards the larger universities. So Michigan State and also U of M has the stronger enrollment in our state. And part of me wonders if that's, you know, more students staying closer to home and then picking those universities, again, an impact from the pandemic. And then, having gone through COVID for all of us, it may change the calibration in terms of wanting to be in a larger university setting for some students too, right? After having to spend, 6 months, a year, 18 months at home in front of a Zoom screen, that might change a student's perspective in terms of what they want. And now that it's finally time for them to go to university. And so perhaps that's some of what is impacting this as well.
Trustee, as we're going into 2022, you did not have to run for re-election. You were appointed. So, you could have hung it up. Why do you want to continue for another 8 years here?
That's a great question. You're right. I was appointed to a term. I agreed to serve it out. And quite frankly, at the time I was appointed, I wasn't thinking about running to keep the seat at all. I was thinking about what can I do to help the board move forward after another trustee had resigned in a somewhat contentious way. I care a lot about Michigan State University. I spent 10 years on the faculty from 2006 to 2016 at the law school. My husband graduated from Michigan State University. In fact, that education would set him on a path that would lead him to become the first African-American Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Texas. My stepson's a graduate. I have two kids at East Lansing Public Schools who have literally grown up on the campus. I mean, they learned to walk at Spartan marching band practices. And so it was very personal for me in terms of taking on the appointment. And in addition to being able to bring my expertise as a legal ethics scholar and an attorney, I'm committed to Michigan State. And then when it came time to make the decision of whether or not I wanted to run to keep the seat, it's that same commitment that has led me to decide I want to continue in this role. And I hope that Michiganders will agree that I'm the right person to keep doing it. There has been an opportunity to do a number of things that I felt were important to have happen, but there is a lot of work that remains. And so I hope to continue being a champion of change for accountability and transparency going forward for a very long time.
Oh, I was just going to say a quick question. Are you still teaching in Houston, and how does that work?
Oh, it's a great question. I am still teaching at the University of Houston. I was appointed to the Doherty Chair in Legal Ethics at the University of Houston in 2016, and I continue to be a law professor there. I taught online part of my classes already pre-pandemic, and so I might have been one of the few faculty members in the country who was very readily able to transition to Zoom life when we all had to be online, and I've continued to teach online. And I may go back to teaching in person one semester a year. I haven't really sorted that out yet, but for now I teach my classes online, so that could be done anywhere. And I still split my time though between Texas and Michigan, but Michigan is home, and it has been for a very long time. And I guess I will say I'm fortunate to have a position that allows me to spend time in both locations.
Renee Kanaki Jefferson, she is the MSU trustee running for re-election in 2022. Appreciate you spending time with us on the podcast.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate Renee Kanaki Jefferson joining us just a minute ago here. Heidi Koloff, direct care worker. Of course, Dennis Denno was here just a little bit ago. You know, it's going to take me a while, I think, to get Huntington Place into my head as what TCF Center and Cobo Hall is called now. When I think Huntington, I'm thinking that this is like a sports arena or something.
No, so I have a Huntington bank account. So when I walked in there, I felt like a VIP. I'm like, oh my gosh, I got the Huntington app on my phone. But no, like I said, I think it definitely is really interesting to see people come together again after being away and remote for so long. And another thing I want to point out is a lot of these older precinct delegates are ecstatic to be able to start knocking on doors again, to start having face-to-face conversations. They're a little more old school. They don't like social media, but they were doing a lot of phone calls, but they all seem pretty ecstatic to start knocking on doors and to have those doors actually be open this time around.
Well, next Monday, Sam, we're going to have you compare a county Republican convention that you're going to cover tonight with the convention you covered on Saturday.
No, I'm excited to make my comparisons, or I don't know. I even liked making the comparison between this Saturday and then the Trump rally that I was at last Saturday. So the Saturday beforehand.
Yeah. A little different crowd, I got to imagine. A little different crowd.
Me and the other reporters, we liked contrasting the music differences.
Oh, yeah.
Trump's rally was definitely more, you know, kind of old school rock, a lot of country. But this one, they had like Garland Gilchrist walking onto the stage to a Jay-Z song.
A little different, that's for sure. Also, thanks to Mark Bayshore for putting this together, AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, for Samantha Schreiber and John Roerink, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.